Stan, you've just held the annual general meeting for the Integrated Landscape Management Program, the research program. What's new? Whereabouts are we now?
Well, we've really gone through a transition based on the first 5 years of the chair. Then we went through a renewal phase and we're into phase two. And phase two has shifted its focus to some extent. We still rely very heavily on trying to build these landscape scenario tools that allow us to project land uses into the future based on our best knowledge of what people plan or want to do and what the implications of that development is on a wide range of indicators, most of them ecological, but some of them economic as well. So we continue to do that. That's the focus, and it has remained that way. But we also have switched in that. Initially, we were developing a lot of very simple relationships between industrial activity and ecological indicators, curves I call dose response curves. And they're simply relationships that tell you as you increase industrial activity, whatever that might be, how do our ecological indicators respond? Many of them go down as we increase the level, and we expect that, but it's important to know that relationship because that gives you information on the trade-offs you're going to have to deal with when you decide on the level of industrial activity you want and the level of ecological performance that you want to maintain in the system. So that's the background basic work that needs to get done, and we do a bit of that. It's ongoing, and that'll become very important when people start to have to make decisions about trade-offs in terms of land use planning. But what we focused more on recently is things we call key uncertainties, things that we don't have enough information on to allow us to model it in a very effective way. It's still up in the air. It's unknown. So if we went one direction with the information, the model would tell us something very different than if we went another direction. It's an uncertainty, and so that's where we hope science should be able to make a major contribution.
What are those key uncertainties?
There are a number of them, but the one we focused on is related to something that is quite unusual that's being introduced into our boreal forest systems, and that's what we call exotic species or species that don't normally occupy that part of the range. And a couple of them that really come to mind are white-tailed deer and coyotes, and a third one are cowbirds that have big effects or potentially big effects on forest birds because they're nest parasites. They lay their eggs in other birds' nests, and that has negative effects on the birds. So these things have been around, but they haven't been very big players in the boreal forest. But we have this inkling that they are now becoming big players. They're much more common, much more widespread. And so the question is, why is that happening? And secondly, what are the implications of that change in the system? And some of the work we're doing with woodland caribou relates to this, and we're seeing very substantive effects. A student by the name of Dave Latham has been studying a caribou herd in northeastern Alberta for over the last 4 or 5 years. And luckily, we worked on that area some 10 years earlier, and we found that the system seemed to be working as it should. And by that, I mean caribou were living in these really low-quality peatlands where nothing else liked to live, primarily moose and wolves. They were in upland areas. And as long as these things separate themselves spatially, the caribou are happy campers. But what we've seen transition, and Dave's data show this very nicely, is deer are now spreading into the peatlands, as are wolves, and that spread into the peatland has led to major increases in mortality of caribou, and now those populations are in fact declining. So Dave's documented this very clearly. The wolves and deer are overlapping a lot with the caribou, and it's creating negative connotations for the caribou. What we still don't know, though, is why the deer are doing this spread. Why are they going in? And I've got a grad student, Kim Daw, who's just starting her research, and there are a number of potential reasons. One might be the climate's changing. So life's just getting better. It's warmer, maybe low snow cover in the winter allows the deer to expand into places where they normally weren't before. Second one is that our industrial activity are creating forest cover types that are good for deer, and that's usually young, shrubby, more open type of vegetation. And that change then leads to the deer expanding into areas, and that that may be due to forestry activities or possibly energy sector activities that create well sites, seismic lines that might have better browse on them. The other third one is we're simply seeing the species expand its range out of core habitat. And good habitat in Alberta for white-tailed deer is this interface between the agriculture and woodlots and that. There's all kinds of deer in that area, and maybe there's just spreading from that foci. And so it's actually agriculture that's quite an important driver. And Kim's looking at all these different aspects to see if we can get an answer to that.
Well, what's amazing is this change has taken place over a very short period of time, 10 years, just a blink of an eye. What does that say to you? What lesson do we have to learn from that?
Well, yeah, these things can change rapidly, and I think the frightening thing about it is that if the change is as substantive as we see, there's no quick fix. It's not going to be easy to make it change back, and this is particularly important for the caribou again. We're really concerned they're a threatened or endangered species. We're going to all kinds of measures to try and maintain these herds. We're asking industry to do a lot of special things to try and allow these herds to be maintained. And if we've got deer expanding widely, we may have a very difficult task in front of us to actually reverse that. And in some other areas, we're doing things like wolf control and short-term proximate things that nobody's happy doing. They have a positive effect on the caribou, but it is short-term, and no one wants to lock into long-term wolf control. So we think we need to do that to allow the vegetation and that to recover to more natural levels after our activity. But that's going to be slow, and if it's climate, and it's deer going in because of climate, then we don't have a hope. We really are into a frustrating situation. So it's fast, it's surprising, and it has all kinds of sobering consequences to the many things we want to manage for.
You have a lot of moving targets as well that you have to deal with. There's climate change now that's very big on everyone's agenda, the mountain pine beetle, and oil sands development. How are you dealing with those?
Well, it made us take a step back. So as I said before, the core has always been in our work is to try and develop these models, these scenario models that allow us to look at the future and take a look at whether our activities are going to have the types of influences we hope they would in terms of meeting our objectives. And we've got some excellent models to do that, but some of the overriding big features that we thought had to be incorporated in were these things like the climate is changing and we better put that into our models in some more effective way. Similarly, if you want to talk about any sort of forest management on the east slopes of the Rockies and the foothills of Alberta, you better have a way to deal with pine beetle because it's right in our face. It's having a big influence. The government's got all kinds of plans as to how to try and cope with that. They have a pine beetle strategy. And so some of the things we thought of our first modeling work has to actually deal with these big issues rather than getting down to some of the details that we thought were important before. So it's a big switch, but we've actually made some very nice progress.
The provincial government has introduced a new program, and that has to do with landscape management. Could you tell me a little bit about that and then also how your program dealing with integrated landscape management and the research you're doing can inform that new government program?
Yeah, well, I think it's all evolved in a very interesting way. I think the government, through public pressure, has realized that we've reached these words that have been used like a tipping point, that we really... many people feel that the level of industrial activity we're seeing on the land base is having negative effects on some of the other values that we hold dearly in Alberta. And that has prompted, I think, the government to respond to develop a plan. And you've heard a lot of this in the politics. And one of the key things that has come out is called a land use framework. And it's a broad-scale document, but it sets the stage for a very important thing that has been missing, and that's regional planning. And by regions, I mean very large areas, not just a municipality, not the entire province, but something in between. And the plan is to actually have six of these regional planning areas. And the idea would be to institute long-term land use planning that incorporates an objective-driven type of approach. And by that I think they mean they're going to set targets for a bunch of values. important values, not only economic ones, how much oil sands money or revenue do you want out, but what do you want for ecological integrity? What do you want for clean air? What do you want for clean water? And if we set those targets in each region, each of these six regions, how would you then plan land use to actually achieve those targets? So that's an amazing change, because we didn't have that before. We've had different versions of it, but this is quite a bit more aggressive in that direction. And the primary direction that I think is a good one is we think we're going to get very strong direction from the government as to the priorities in these different regions. Great example is the northeast region of Alberta is going to have oil sands as a priority. And it makes no sense not to have that as a priority. But once you set that priority, there's a bunch of things that trickle down in terms of these other human objectives. And the great example is we're not going to have ecological integrity be maintained at a high level in that part of the world. It just can't happen. So we have to live with those trade-offs. But I think once we accept the trade-offs, we can actually do a far better job of land use planning. And so our work comes in, again, in terms of, okay, you've got this plan, you've got this priority, you've set the targets, and we hope the targets will get set on our dose response curve trade-offs, that knowledge that we've supplied there. But once those are set, what's your plan for how to get to reaching those targets? And that's where these land use scenario models come in beautifully. You can actually run things with a plan that you're going to have twice the output of barrels of oil out of the oil sands that we have now. Well, what are the implications to various things? What if we had 20% more protected areas as being proposed by the CIMA group in that part of the world? What are the implications to wildlife, to caribou, to the oil sands output, to forest companies in the area? We can explore all those sorts of questions with these types of models we're building in the lab.
Will people accept that in the sense that you can set priorities, but everybody wants everything and they don't want to give up anything?
Yeah, and I think Albertans have to get realistic. We're currently giving up a lot, and the priorities are set. They're just set in a soft way. We get all kinds of signals from the government that we are not stopping oil sands development. So the priority is set. But as long as we try and not and fight that and try and play these games where we're really not serious about that and we and pay all this lip service to these other sorts of values, what happens is those other values slowly deteriorate without anybody really knowing about it. And in the end, I think you achieve far less than being upfront about setting the targets and then working towards achieving them. But believe me, the setting of those targets is going to mean that we can't continue with this idea that if some individual's got this great idea that they want to do agriculture in some part of the boreal forest where nobody's done it before, we shouldn't be encouraging that. The priorities should tell you, this is zoned for oil sands. This is zoned for forestry. Don't consider an activity that's incompatible with that priority. It just makes sense to me. We do this in urban environments all the time, where we zone for industry, zone for residential, zone for commercial. And once those rules are laid out, it works pretty effectively. We probably have to do that on our green land base and other parts of our land base in the province as well.
What's on your research agenda for the next year?
We're continuing on the same line as what we've done this past year. As I said, we've made some great progress. We've got to figure out why these deer are expanding, because I think it has broad management implications for a variety of things. We want to really roll our sleeves up and get into this land use planning in a big way, working at these big regions. The first one that's going to get rolled out is probably going to be northeastern Alberta, so we're heavily involved in actually running various models, and we want to stay involved with the ideas that people have as to how this might look. But there will be other ones that will unfold very quickly after that, a northern Alberta one that hooks in with the foothills and the south as well. So there are a whole bunch of opportunities where there will be a bunch of scenario planning need to be done, and we're hoping that our lab can be heavily involved in that.
Thank you very much, Stan.
You're welcome.